So I don't have to tell you that it was a terrible week on the world stage. It ended, of course, with the unspeakable tragedy of a civilian airliner downed and hundreds killed. But also, this was the week in which the IDF began to go in to the Gaza Strip, an invasion whose dimension and whose consequences are as yet unknown. It's not as though we did not anticipate that this might happen, but nonetheless, we now have to wait and see what it means, the first IDF soldier, Eitan Barak, having lost his life. We have to wait and see what it means over the days and perhaps weeks to come. And in speaking with some of my rabbinic colleagues over the past week, we essentially all had the same question, which is, what do you say that you haven't said? You could pull out the sermon from last week, last year, the year before. Since there's nothing new essentially in what's going on, and in fact, I think it was on Jon Stewart, where he said there is something new about this war in Gaza. What's new is it's happening today. And that is, in fact, in some ways, the only difference is that it's happening now as opposed to the previous, because the themes are the same. And part of what I decided I ought to do today is just to remind all of us of the essential points. And I do this because the truth is that the human tragedies that are happening in Gaza, four children who were killed on a roof, four children who were killed on a beach, those things may continue to happen. And to any human heart, and I hope to any Jewish heart, they are painful and awful and dispiriting. And so, in order to understand why it's happening, we have to keep in mind the bedrock essentials, and I'm going to try to reduce them to four so that we can more easily, in discussions with others who don't understand what's going on, we can more easily explain. And the first, which is really important, and in some ways encapsulates the theme that is most crucial for us to repeat to the world, is to reverse the assumption that the occupation causes the war. Forget quibbling about the word occupation for a moment. That's a separate issue, and we'll come to that. In fact, the exact opposite is true. If you remember, from 1948 to 1967, for the Jewish people, there was no West Bank and Gaza. The West Bank was called Jordan. Gaza was called Egypt. And in fact, when the 67 war began, Israel made explicit overtures to Jordan not to get into the war, and Jordan really didn't want to so much, but felt pressured to and did. So when someone tells you occupation causes war, explain to them that actually they need to reverse the sentence, which is war caused occupation. Had the 67 war not happened, had Nasser not amassed troops on the border, had the Arab nations not promised to throw Israel into the sea, Gaza would still be part of Egypt and be okay with us. And the West Bank would still be called Jordan. So if you fight a war and then the consequences of that war become the reason that you say you're fighting a war, there's something wrong with your logic. And all of us need to have that first and foremost in our minds, because it's very important to explain to people who don't understand. So when someone says they're fighting because Israel's on the West Bank, say, no, Israel's on the West Bank because they were fighting. Once you understand that, then the second point to keep in mind is culture. Because if Israel had taken over the West Bank and found the Balinese, or to use Bret Stephens' example, the Canadians, I promise you, it would be a state today. It would. You could have Quebec in Nablus. No Israeli would object. Well, a couple would. But you could. So it wasn't just that that incited Israel to take over the territory, but then the experience of what it was that the people who lived in that territory wanted and want made it impossible to leave it alone. To the extent that it was possible to disengage, Israel tried. Sharon finally got sick of Gaza and said, okay, give it to them. And as you know, Canada did not arise on the Mediterranean. Instead, what you got was, rather than all these billions of dollars of aid that have gone into the Palestinian Authority in order to enrich the banks in Switzerland, what you got instead of building projects and resorts and infrastructure were terror tunnels that would funnel weapons and rocket launchers built on the roofs of schools, and an increased radicalization. That's important to know, because the third essential point after how did the conflict start and who is it that's fighting is a word that I want to define for you in a way that may not be the way that you normally hear it defined in the media, and that is proportionality. Because it is easy to assume, and I think very reasonable on the part of most people to assume, because remember, most people are actually not living this 24 hours a day. I know that's surprising. When Israelis come to the United States and they go, say, to Wichita, they're shocked. Nobody's talking about Israel. So for people who don't talk about Israel 24 hours a day, proportionality does seem very off. That is, they fire a rocket, it misses. We send in bombers and precision destroy buildings with inevitably civilian casualties. That's disproportionate. They didn't kill us and we did kill them. What better definition of disproportion could you possibly have? But actually, when you're in a fight, if somebody has a gun and they fire at you and miss, and you beat them up very badly, but you leave the gun in their hand, you have used disproportionate violence, but disproportionate in the opposite direction. Because proportionate violence is violence that takes away the threat. If the person still has a gun in their hand so that now you can turn around and leave and they can shoot you in the back, then I say you've been disproportionate, but in the wrong direction. Proportion means the minimal amount of violence to remove the threat directed against you. In other words, as long as you can fire rockets at the population centers of Israel, the violence has not been great enough to remove the threat, and therefore has not been disproportionate, unless you consider it disproportionate, we haven't used enough violence. It's not a game of you use proportionate violence if you kill more of theirs than they kill of yours. It's a game of you use proportionate violence if you have removed the possibility of their killing many of yours. Because as we know from that Malaysian airliner, the technology to kill hundreds of people is easily transferred to people who either don't know how to use it very well, or even worse, who know how to use it very well. And if you think that that kind of technology couldn't find its way into Gaza, then you are deluded. Of course it could. Which is one of the reasons why, unlike that Malaysian airliner, El Al flights are all equipped with various security radar and other devices, because we know there are only certain places you can fly and certain ways you can fly to get people there safely. So remember, when you hear the word proportion, that person who you beat up who still has a gun in their hand, as long as the gun is in the hand of the person who wants to kill you, you have not used proportionate violence to defeat them. Nobody in Israel wanted to go in with ground troops. Nobody did. And had the rockets stopped, nobody would have. But I want you, whether you love him or hate him or feel indifferent or whatever, I want you to, for one moment, to think of yourself as Benjamin Netanyahu. Not that you have this historic responsibility for the state, although you do. But every time you go out for the newspaper and you buy a newspaper from the vendor, you think to yourself, his safety and the safety of his family, they're in my hands. Every time you walk into a synagogue and you look around, you think the safety of every person in this synagogue, their safety's in my hands, the decisions that I make. Everybody you went to school with, everybody you work with, everybody who's been kind to you, everybody who's been nice to your children, you have to remember every single day as the Prime Minister of Israel that whether their family lives or dies is largely in your hands. You go to bed with that responsibility and you wake up with it in the morning and it never goes away. So it isn't only that you're responsible for the soldiers who are going into Gaza, you're responsible for everyone. Now that's true, for example, of the President of the United States. It's true for the Prime Minister of Canada, but not like it is for Netanyahu. Because he's making decisions every single day that will have a profound effect on whether Israelis live or die. Because remember, in the background of all of this, of what's going on in Gaza, there was just an extension in the nuclear negotiations in Iran. So that's going on too. And therefore, you dare not be disproportionate in the wrong direction. Because every time that rocket falls, you feel like it's because I didn't stop it. And for those of you who have lived in Israel, you know that living in Israel is almost like living in a small town. That is, if you grow up there, everyone knows everyone who knows everyone. There may be 2 degrees of separation. That's just the reality of a population that is smaller than the population of Los Angeles. And that brings us to the fourth point, after how the war really started, after the question of the culture of our enemies, and after the question of proportionality. There's the question of this Shabbat morning, where I talked about the fact that we are in the 3 weeks and we remember very vividly, again and again and again in Jewish history, what it is to be powerless. It is encoded in our spiritual DNA. You want to know what it is to be powerless? I don't know if you saw that the Arab teenager who was killed by Jewish fanatics was just declared in Israel a victim of terrorism. In Israel. In other words, Israel is saying the Israelis who did this were terrorists. What it is to have experienced powerlessness, if you do it right, is to identify with the powerlessness of others. But it is also to know that history does not give infinite chances, not even to the Jewish people. That every people has a point beyond which they can't survive another destruction. And we don't know when that will be, but we dare not chance it. And therefore, not only must Israel err on the side of power, but we must remember that we bear a profound historical responsibility. A profound historical responsibility. To express to the world the situation that Israel is in, as well as supporting in every way we can our sisters and brothers who are in that situation. It means partly that we have to explain it. You're probably reading about Iron Dome, writes a blogger who was posted on CNN, and the miracles it is enabling. Iron Dome does not protect our communities. We're too close to the Gaza border. In order for Iron Dome to be able to intercept a rocket or missile, the trajectory has to have time to achieve a minimal altitude. The short-distance rockets that plague us don't get that high before they come down to endanger us. Instead, we have the red alert system that gives us 10 seconds to reach safety. Think of that the next time you're driving to the grocery store. Can you stop the car, get the baby and the 3-year-old out of their car seats, and make it to cover in 10 seconds before the rocket hits? We have a responsibility. One of the reasons that we have the 3 weeks is to remind us of who we are and where we have been. And you know, and I know, that the saddest part of this entire situation is that the deepest desire of many of the people that surround us is not for peace, but that we be destroyed. That they want the kind of peace that you get when you wipe out your enemies and you sow the ground with salt. That's the peace they're looking for. And until that changes, there can't be the peace that we're looking for. Remind people who don't understand that when Sadat came to Jerusalem with the most intractable, difficult, defensive, nationalist prime minister Israel has ever had, Menachem Begin, Begin gave him back the Sinai. Would we give back territory? And the Sinai was much bigger than Gaza and the West Bank combined, much. Would we give back territory for peace if we only had somebody who really wanted peace in a second? In a second. But we're not there yet. So it's not disproportionate We didn't start it. And God knows we would end it if we could. There are lots of other messages, lots of other rights and wrongs, lots of other crisscrossing arguments, but those are the essentials. And everybody who is honest about what is going on in the Middle East knows it, which is why, shockingly, you have not heard nearly as much condemnation of Israel on the world stage as you have in the past. Now, that may change. The pressure is building. But everyone knows that if you're part of a state and your neighbor keeps lobbing rockets onto you, whether they hit or not, sooner or later, you got to do something. Everyone knows that. We have to keep repeating it. Finally, I want to end the same way I did last week, because I think this is important. And that is, just because it is difficult and intractable and painful and long-lasting doesn't make it hopeless. Jews aren't allowed to be hopeless. I quoted, I believe, in the Family Minyan. I don't know that I said it in the main sanctuary. If I did, forgive me. I'll tell you the story again. It's a good story, and good stories always bear repeating. That when Isaac Bashevis Singer received the Nobel Prize and he was asked, why do you write in Yiddish? After all, Yiddish is a dying language. Singer, who had seen the destruction of his Eastern European world, said, listen, in Jewish history, between dying and dead is a very great distance. We're not allowed to be hopeless. Yeah, it's difficult. Yes, it's intractable. Yes, anti-Semitism. Well, there's a book about it that's called The Longest Hatred. It has been for thousands of years, but don't believe that all that can be is what has been. The world can surprise you. Things that we thought would be ascendant disappear, and things that we have never imagined have arisen. Just look around you. Our ancestors would never have believed that there could be a Jewish community like this one. Not in their wildest, fondest dreams. So we're not allowed to be despairing or hopeless or have the luxury of just being too tired to help and to fight. For thousands of years we dreamed of this. And nothing, not in the Torah, not in the Talmud, not in medieval times, nothing ever promised us that it would be easy. We have awful enemies and a little land. But we also have the Jewish people and the goodwill of many people of goodwill in the world. I say this because I know next week is going to be another difficult week. I can promise you that. But we will make it through. Take courage. Speak up. Let the world know that for all of the rockets and enemies and history and memory, Am Yisrael Chai, the nation of Israel, lives and will continue to live. Shabbat Shalom.